Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. This week, we have a very special episode for all of you, and that is the case because I will be talking about everything I watched at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. That being said, apart from all of those reviews and apart from me talking about all of those films, this whole episode is also going to be paired with music from the movie Aftersun. Now, before I jump into what I thought about all of these films, let's go into our first musical break and let's go listen to Losing My Religion by REM. And here it is.
Sad enough, I you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. I hope you'll enjoy that musical break, but now it is time to jump into our main topic of the day, and that is everything I watched at VIFF. So the 41st edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival just happened from the 29th of September until the 9th of October, and in this time I was able to watch 15 movies. First of all, I would like to begin by thanking VIFF for inviting us to cover the Vancouver International Film Festival as members of the press. It was an amazing experience. We had a lot of fun. And from the bottom of my heart, I just want to let you know that I really, really appreciate it. Now, that being said, it is time we start talking about the movies that I saw at this year's festival, starting with the first one, Rabia Kurnaz versus George W. Bush. So when it comes to Rabia Kurnaz versus George W. Bush, I am kind of cheating because I technically didn't watch this film during the festival. Instead, I watched it on August 19 at a surprise screening that VIFF held for members. I watched this film months ago, but it did play during the festival, so I am including it. So this movie, Rabia Kurnaz versus George W. Bush, it follows Rabia Kurnaz, a Turkish housewife from Bremen, Germany, as she discovers that her eldest son, Murat, was detained in Pakistan by the United States government and is currently being held in Guantanamo-Bay detention camp. This is a German film directed by Andres Dresen. It is based on a real-life story, and I thought it was extremely mediocre. The performances are strong, it is competently made from a technical perspective, and the real-life story that the movie is based on is clearly very interesting. That said, I thought this movie was an absolute tonal mess. Even though this film explores some incredibly heavy topics, you know, these are topics such as racial profiling, torture, and the inhuman treatment of prisoners, even though this film tackles all of those subjects, it still insists in being a comedy, and it just doesn't work. This film's tone is all over the place, and not in a good way. You know, in one scene, the film wants you to feel disturbed by what is going on with the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay prison, but in the very next scene, the film wants you to laugh at a stupid, bottom-of-the-barrel joke that, if I'm being honest, doesn't land. So yeah, in my opinion, it was a huge mistake to tell this movie as a comedy, and if I were to give it a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 5 out of 10, which means I thought it was meh. Now, in the first day of the film festival, which was September 29th, I watched one movie, which was Bones of Crows. This was actually the movie that opened the entire festival, and we actually got invited to cover the red carpet premiere for this film. If you guys are interested in checking out our red carpet coverage, you know, go to our YouTube channel, watch the video right now. We even got the chance to interview the film's director, Marie Clements. Bones of Crows is a psychological drama told through the eyes of Cree matriarch Aline Spears as she survives Canada's residential school system to continue her family's generational fight in the face of systemic starvation, racism, and sexual abuse. This is a Canadian film directed by Marie Clements. It is inspired by true events, and I thought this movie was good. Not bad, not mediocre, but not great either. I thought it was good. The story that the movie tells is extremely important. The film has some very powerful and emotional moments, and on top of that, the film does a great job of raising awareness of the residential school system and everything that happened here in Canada. That said, I thought some of the lines of dialogue were a bit too heavy-handed, and in all honesty, I thought the story was extremely messy. You know, the film is trying to tell six different stories at the same time, and I don't really know if that approach worked. At the very end, the film is sort of able to tie all those stories up in a satisfying way, but for the first two acts, I just felt this film was extremely unfocused and extremely messy. Considering that, If I were to give Bones of Crows a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 6 out of 10, which means I thought it was good. Now, on September 30th, I watched two movies, and the first one of those films was Empire of Light. According to the synopsis, Empire of Light is a drama about the power of human connection during turbulent times, set in an English coastal town in the early 1980s. This movie was written and directed by Sam Mendes, who directed some amazing films such as American Beauty, Skyfall, and 1917. It has cinematography by the great Roger Deakins, who, in my opinion, is one of the best directors of photography of all time. And it also has music by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who won Oscars for their work in The Social Network and Soul. This movie should have been an absolute slam dunk. That said, if I'm being completely honest, I thought Empire of Light was one of the most disappointing movies of the entire year. The story is bland, the characters are bland, the messages are extremely trite and cliché, and everything about it just honestly felt uninspired. And what frustrates me the most is that this is a movie about the power of cinema. I love movies. I believe wholeheartedly in the power of cinema. I should have loved this film. That said, if I'm being honest, it just left me feeling a bit cold. Now, even though I clearly wasn't that impressed with this movie, there is one thing that I do have to highlight, because there is one single element in this film that is truly, truly exceptional. And that is, without a doubt, Olivia Colman's performance. Olivia Colman is an incredible actress. She is so, so talented, and she has given some amazing performances in the past couple of years. That said, even though she has done some great work, this, her performance in Empire of Light, is some of her finest work. And honestly, it's kind of a shame that such a great performance is hidden in this pile of mediocrity. But yeah, when it comes to my thoughts of Empire of Light, if I were to give it a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 6 out of 10, just simply because of Olivia Colman's performance. It is so good that it manages to bring this film's score into the positive, but just barely. Now, the second movie that I watched on the 30th was Decision to Leave. Decision to Leave is a romantic suspense thriller that revolves around a detective case, but one that is more interested in its characters than in its story's revelations. This is a South Korean film directed by Park Chan-wook, and I was extremely excited for this movie. And the main reason why I was so excited is because I am a huge Park Chan-wook fan. For those of you who don't know, Park Chan-wook has directed absolute masterpieces such as Oldboy and The Handmaiden. If you haven't watched those films, definitely check those out. But yeah, anyways, I love Park Chan-wook, I love his body of work, and I was extremely excited for this movie, and I am very happy to say that Decision to Leave did not disappoint. I thought this movie was absolutely amazing. Now, one of the things that I love the most about this movie is that it is without a doubt a neo-noir, and what I mean by that is that this film in some ways resembles the classic film noirs from the golden age of Hollywood. The plot is intentionally convoluted and at times difficult to follow. There is a femme fatale, which means, you know, a female character who seduces the protagonist and who also might be dangerous. And there is also this fatalistic aura that surrounds the entire film and makes it so much more intriguing. Now, by far my favorite thing of Decision to Leave is without a doubt the symbolism, because this movie is oozing with symbolism and subtext. There are so many symbols that in all honesty, I haven't been able to stop thinking about this film since I watched it. There are many symbols that I think I understand, or at least I hope I do, but there are many more that I still haven't been able to decipher, and that really, really intrigues me. Now, if I were to point just two symbols out, I would say that the most significant symbols in this film are mountains and the sea. Of course, I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm not going to let you know what I think the mountains and the sea symbolize in this movie. But just know that mountains and the sea are featured frequently throughout Decision to Leave. You know, not only do we have many shots in mountains and the sea, but also characters are constantly talking about whether they prefer one over the other. One of the final images of the entire movie is literally a representation of the union in between the mountains and the sea, and one of the posters of the movie literally shows our characters standing between mountains and the sea. So in conclusion, Decision to Leave had some incredible performances and some of the craziest cinematography and editing I've seen all year. If I were to give this film a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 9 out of 10, because I thought this movie was absolutely amazing. Now, moving on October 1st, I watched two movies, and the first one of those films is The Sun. The Son is a drama about a father, played by Hugh Jackman, who has his busy life with his new partner and their baby thrown into disarray when his ex-wife Kate turns up with her teenage son, Nicholas. This is the newest film from director Florian Zeller, who previously directed The Father. For those of you who don't know, this is a movie that won Anthony Hopkins an Oscar for Best Actor. And this film, just like The Father, is also based on a play written by him. I'm not gonna lie, walking into The Son, I was very nervous. And the reason why I was so nervous is because this film has been getting some terrible reviews coming out of other film festivals. And honestly, that is something that really surprised me. And the reason why that surprised me so much is because I love The Father. I generally think it is one of the best movies of 2020. And this film, The Son, is based on a play by Florian Zeller, just like The Father, is written by Christopher Hampton, just like The Father, has cinematography by Ben Smithard, just like The Father, and is directed by Florian Zeller, just like The Father. Considering that, I find it very hard to believe that the same team behind The Father would suddenly make a terrible film. And you know what? Call me crazy if you want, but I thought The Son was pretty freaking great. You know, the performances by Hugh Jackman, Vanessa Kirby, and Laura Dern are absolutely phenomenal. The story was emotional and poignant, the flashbacks were utilized to perfection, and the music by Hans Zimmer is, of course, amazing. Now, to address some of the things that critics have been saying about The Son, all I will say is that the main criticisms that I've seen being thrown at this film are, first of all, that Sam McGrath's performance wasn't great, and second of all, that the film was way too manipulative. In regards to the first point of criticism, that Sam McGrath's performance wasn't great, genuinely, I kind of agree with this criticism. You know, I certainly didn't think that his performance was great, but I didn't think it was bad either, or at least for me, it never sucked me out of the experience. But now, in regards to the second point of criticism, the idea that the film is too manipulative, this is just a critique that I genuinely don't agree with. And the reason why I don't agree with this point of criticism is that the whole point of this movie, as well as The Father's, is to make you feel like the characters on screen. In The Father, Florian Zeller manipulates you into feeling as if you have dementia. And in The Son, Florian Zeller is doing the exact same thing. He is manipulating you, but this time to make you feel as if you were depressed. So is it manipulative? Yes, absolutely. But it is meant to be. Considering that, I genuinely enjoyed The Son. And if I were to give it a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it an 8 out of 10 because I personally thought it was great. But once again, take my words with a grain of salt because I am clearly in the minority for this one. Now, the second movie that I watched on the 1st of October was The Banshees of Inisherin. The Banshees of Inisherin is a drama slash comedy about two lifelong friends who find themselves in an impasse when one of them suddenly decides to abruptly end their relationship. This movie was written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who has directed some incredible films such as In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And when it comes to The Banshees of Inisherin, I absolutely adore this film. The performances by Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson are absolutely incredible. They are teaming up once again after In Bruges, and they absolutely kill it. That said, there are two other performances that I have to highlight, and that is Carrie Condon and Barry Keoghan. They also kick it out of the park when it comes to The Banshees of Inisherin. Now, when it comes to the script of this film, I thought this script is one of the best and most clever scripts of the entire year. And the reason why I love it so much is because it is so, so simple, and yet Martin McDonagh is able to do some amazing things with it. You know, when I heard that this movie was about a friendship between two guys that suddenly ends when one of the two decides he doesn't want to speak to the other anymore, I thought for sure there was going to be more to the story, and I just simply wasn't aware of it. That said, that is not the case. That is literally the entire movie. This entire movie is just Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell are friends until one day Brendan Gleeson decides he doesn't want to speak to Colin Farrell anymore. That is it. That said, the script is so absolutely excellent that it is able to grab such a simple and limited premise and explores it in such a way where it never becomes repetitive and you always feel that the stakes are being raised. And on top of that, this script is so good that this movie is one of the very few I've ever seen that has been able to make me laugh and cry almost simultaneously. Now, apart from everything that I've already mentioned, the thing that elevated the movie for me and turned it into an absolute masterpiece is without a doubt the philosophical dilemmas that can be found at the heart of this movie. These are questions such as, what exactly gives meaning to our life? What makes our lives worth living? Is it enough to just be a good person and to make those around us happy? Or do we have to be remembered in order for our lives to be meaningful? And without giving anything away, these are questions that The Banshees of Inisherin perfectly explores. And as someone who has wrestled with these dilemmas myself, I adore seeing this clash of ideals being brought to life by Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson's characters. So yeah, if I were to give this film a score in between 1 to 10, I would definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, give it a 10 out of 10 because The Banshees of Inisherin is an absolute masterpiece. Now, on the next day of the film festival, on October 2nd, I watched three movies, and all three of these films are going to be distributed by A24. So in a way, on October the 2nd, I watched an A24 triple shot. And the first film that I saw as part of this A24 triple shot was Close. According to its synopsis, Close tells the story of the intense friendship between two 13-year-old boys, Leo and Remy, and what happens when it suddenly gets disrupted. This is a Belgian film directed by Lucas Dont, and I thought this movie was really freaking great. The human moments that this movie is able to capture are both subtle and beautiful. All the performances are incredible, and this movie was able to pull on my heartstrings like very few have done. There is not much I can say about this movie because I don't want to give away what this film is actually about, but all I'm gonna say is that by the end of this film, there was genuinely not a single dry eye in the entire theater. If I were to give a score to Close, I would give it an 8 out of 10, which means I thought this film was great. Now, the second movie that I watched as part of this A24 triple shot was actually my most anticipated movie of the entire festival, and this film is The Whale. According to its synopsis, The Whale is a drama about a reclusive and obese English teacher as he attempts to reconnect with his strange teenage daughter. This is the newest film directed by Darren Aronofsky, who has directed absolute masterpieces such as Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, and Black Swan. I am a huge Darren Aronofsky fan, therefore, needless to say, I was extremely excited for this film. Not only because I'm a huge Aronofsky fan and I love his body of work, but also because everyone who has seen this film has been saying that Brendan Fraser's performance in The Whale is one of the best of the entire year. In fact, this film got a 6-minute standing ovation coming out of the Venice International Film Festival, and there is an extremely heartwarming video of Brendan Fraser just being overwhelmed by joy and tearing up as people are clapping for him and cheering for his performance. If you haven't seen the video, definitely check it out. Anyways, I was very excited for The Whale, and I am very happy to say that this film did not disappoint, and I thought The Whale was absolutely amazing. Now, before I keep talking about The Whale, I have to say that this movie is not going to be for everyone. This film is extremely depressing, and at times it can be very hard to watch. On top of that, the entire movie takes place on a very limited location, and the film is made up almost entirely of conversations. So yes, The Whale is not going to be for everyone. That said, it was for me. In my opinion, Brendan Fraser not only gives the best performance of the year, but also one of the best performances I've ever seen, period. This performance is absolutely amazing. That said, apart from an incredible performance from Brendan Fraser, there is something else that I really love about this movie, and that is the fact that this film works like a Rorschach test of sorts. And what I mean by that is that just like a Rorschach test, your interpretation of this film depends just as much on the film itself as it does on you. I believe wholeheartedly that depending on who you are as a person and what your beliefs are, you're going to get something completely different out of this film. And this is something that became clear to me right after we watched The Whale and I asked my friends what they thought of the film's characters. You know, I was fascinated by the fact that we read these characters in completely different ways. A character that I thought was extremely selfless, some of my friends described as selfish. A character that I felt pity for, some of my friends absolutely hated, and so on, so on. So yeah, I truly believe that what you get out of The Whale and your opinions on the film's characters will be unique to you and will depend on your perspective on life. Depending on if you are an optimist or a pessimist, or in other words, a glass half full or glass half empty sort of person, your interpretation of this film will change. And that is something that I find absolutely fascinating. In The Whale, Brendan Fraser's character believes that people are incapable of not caring. But will you believe in the same thing? I don't know, but that's for you to find out. If I were to give it a score to The Whale, I would give it a 9 out of 10, because I thought this movie was absolutely amazing. Now, the third movie that I watched as part of this A24 triple shot was Aftersun. Aftersun follows Sophie as she reflects on the shared joy and private melancholy of a holiday she took with her father 20 years earlier. Memories real and imagined fill the gaps between as she tries to reconcile the father that she knew with the man she didn't. This film was directed by Charlotte Wells, and I'll be honest, this is a movie that has grown on me quite a lot. When I first watched it, I thought it was great, but I thought it was a bit too simple. That said, the more I think about it, the more I love it, and right now, I think Aftersun was absolutely amazing. After Sun does a lot with very little. You know, this is one of those films that are deceptively simple. At first glance, this seems to be a basic story about a girl going on a vacation with her father, but when you really think about it, you quickly realize that this movie is about so, so much more. After Sun can be slow and plotless, but it is also filled with some of the most human moments I've seen all year. The cinematography is gorgeous, the performances by Paul Mescal and Frankie Corio are incredible, and the ending scene is absolutely beautiful and features the best use of the song Under Pressure that I've ever seen. If I were to give After Sun a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 9 out of 10 because I thought this film was truly, truly amazing. So moving on the next day of VIFF, which was October 3rd, I watched two movies, but totally unrelated, this was also the day when I met Bob Odenkirk, who, of course, is famous for playing the role of Saul Goodman in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Bob Odenkirk was at my university filming an upcoming TV show called The Straight Man, so yeah, not related to VIFF at all, but I met one of my favorite actors of all time, so I thought I should just mention it. Now, the first movie that I saw on October 3rd was Corsage. Corsage is a fictional account of 1 year in the life of Empress Elizabeth of Austria. It is an Austrian film directed by Marie Kreutzer, and I thought this film was very good. Honestly, there is not much that I have to say about Corsage. You know, I thought Vicky Krieps was great as the film's protagonist, I thought the cinematography was very pretty, and I thought the production design and costumes were breathtaking. On top of that, I also really love the fact that this movie focuses on showing us Elizabeth of Austria, not as a ruler or as a historical figure, but as a real human being with strengths, weaknesses, needs, and desires. So yeah, I liked this movie. That said, I did think it was a bit slow at times, and I thought it was, at the end of the day, a bit unremarkable and unmemorable. If I were to give it a score out of 10, I would give it a 7 out of 10, which means I thought this film was very good. Now, the second movie that I watched on October 3rd was Triangle of Sadness. Triangle of Sadness is a dark comedy about a fashion model celebrity couple who join an eventful cruise for the super rich, and then madness ensues. This is the newest film from director Ruben Östlund, who is famous for directing movies such as Force Majeure and The Square, and this is actually the film that won the Palme d'Or at this year's Cannes International Film Festival. Now, I will preface this by saying that I've never seen any of Ruben Östlund's body of work. That said, I was very excited for this movie, and I thought Triangle of Sadness was great, but it could have been better. This is a dark comedy with some very funny moments. It is a satire that has the subtlety of a sledgehammer, which means none. And it is very obvious what this film is trying to say and what it's poking fun at, but in my opinion, that is not a bad thing. You know, it is very obvious that Triangle of Sadness criticizes the pretentiousness and entitlement of some rich people, the phoniness and hypocrisy of the lives they live, and just how detached they are from the real world and its problems. Now, I don't want to give anything away because I believe this is a movie where it is better to go in blind. The less you know about Triangle of Sadness, the better. All I will say is that while I really, really love the first two acts of this movie, the third one, not so much. If I'm being honest, all throughout the first act, I thought Triangle of Sadness was going to be one of my favorite movies of the year. Then, the second act, it started getting a bit repetitive, but it was still amazing, and the second act includes one of the most insane sequences I've ever seen in film. You guys will know what I'm talking about when you watch the movie. That being said, even though I think the first two acts are really freaking great, the third one I'm not the biggest fan of. You know, I think it starts getting redundant, I think it starts getting repetitive, and I honestly think that towards the end, the film begins to lose steam. That being said, even though the third act is not as strong as the first two, I do think the first two are so freaking great that I would still say Triangle of Sadness is a great movie. So yeah, if I were to give a score to Triangle of Sadness, I would give it an 8 out of 10, which means I thought it was great. That being said, if the third act would have been stronger, this could honestly be a lot higher. Now, on the next day of the Vancouver International Film Festival on October 4th, I actually went to a screening of Nosferatu that happened inside a church with live music. And, you know, even though this film sort of doesn't count for what I'm talking about, because, after all, Nosferatu came out 100 years ago in 1922, I thought this was a great experience and I just thought I needed to share. As I said, we saw this movie inside a church, and there was live music by the band Big Kill, and even though I thought the movie was very strange and not at all what I was expecting, I still had fun. Now, on the next day of the film festival, which is October 1st, I watched one movie, and that movie is Women Talking. Women Talking is a drama about the women of an isolated religious community who have to decide what to do after discovering that they are being sexually abused by the men in their community. This film was directed by Sarah Polley, who, by the way, made one of my favorite documentaries of all time, Stories We Tell. Definitely check that out. But in regards to Women Talking, I thought this film was very good. The performances are absolutely amazing, particularly Jessie Buckley, Claire Foy, and Rooney Mara. And the story is very powerful and extremely important. That being said, I do have some problems with this movie. And my first problem is the color grading. If I'm being honest, I thought the color grading of this film made it look a bit ugly and distracting. And I can definitely see what they're going for, and I sort of understand why this creative decision was taken, but in my opinion, it really didn't work out that well. Now, the second problem that I have with this film is that I thought it felt a bit anticlimactic. I felt that throughout the entire movie, the film was building up towards something that ultimately never ended up happening, so in my opinion, this film wasn't that satisfying from a narrative perspective. But yeah, in conclusion, if I were to give a score to Women Talking, I would give it a 7 out of 10, which means I thought it was very good. Moving on October 6th, the next day of VIF, I watched one movie, but before that, I went to an event called An Evening with Michael Abels. For those of you who don't know, Michael Abels is the legendary composer who wrote genre-defying scores for all three of Jordan Peele's films. These are, of course, Get Out, Us, and Nope, and this event was absolutely incredible. Michael Abels talked about his creative process, he told us about the inspiration behind the music, and he also told us about conversations he had with Jordan Peele that were very, very interesting. On top of that, he even told us what the mysterious words that can be heard at the beginning of the Get Out score actually mean. And that was really freaking cool. So yeah, An Evening with Michael Abels was an amazing experience, and I just wanted to thank my friend Isa for getting me to this event for free. Thank you so much. That being said, the one movie that I saw right after An Evening with Michael Abels was RMN. RMN is a drama about a man who returns to his small Transylvanian village a few days before Christmas. This is a Romanian film written and directed by Christian Monicu, who, for those of you who don't know, he directed one of the most disturbing movies I've ever seen. That movie is 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, and that film is extremely hard to watch, extremely unsettling, but also, it is a pretty amazing film. Considering that, I was very excited for RMN, but I also was a bit hesitant. I didn't know what I was going into, and I was afraid that it was going to be just as fucked up as, you know, his previous films. That said, I'm very happy to let you all know that I thought RMN was great. It is not as disturbing as 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, but it is still a bit unsettling. At its essence, this movie is an exploration of racism and how it can transform into mass hysteria if left unchecked. In the small town where this movie is set, racist sentiments grow out of proportion and snowball uncontrollably until there's no way back. If I'm being honest, I believe this movie did an excellent job of showing that behind racism and exclusion, there's nothing but pathetic fear. A fear that is oftentimes unfounded and one that would disappear if people truly took the time to get to know each other. Now, apart from what I already mentioned, I also wanted to say that I love this film's setting. And the reason why I love it so much is because I think it's a great idea to have a story about racism and exclusion being set during Christmas. You know, after all, Christmas is a holiday that is all about empathy and inclusivity. But here in this film, the stark contrast between what the holiday is meant to be and what it actually is, it packs a heavy punch. Now, something else that I have to mention is actually my favorite part of the entire film, and that is a scene that features a very heated discussion that includes almost everyone in town. In this scene, residents share their opinions of what they believe should happen to the foreigners that have come to their town, and this scene is amazing, not only because this discussion is extremely intense and painfully realistic, but what makes this scene truly exceptional is that all of this, all of that discussion is captured in one single uninterrupted shot. This is a scene that goes on for 15 minutes, and it is captured in just one shot. I can't even begin to comprehend the amount of work that must have gone behind this single one scene. That said, it paid off because it is absolutely incredible. On top of that, the last thing that I would like to mention is the film's ending. This film's ending is incredible and very, very memorable. It is very confusing, it is very enigmatic, but I mean that in the best way possible. I'm not going to give anything away, but all I will say is that I am still thinking about that ending to this day, and I am still struggling to understand what the hell it meant. So in conclusion, when it comes to RMN, I would give it an 8 out of 10 because I thought this movie was great. Now, on the next day of VIF, October 7, I rested, and this was very much needed at this point. That said, just the next day, in October 8, I went back to VIF to watch the last two movies I would watch in the entire film festival, and the first one of these films was Broker. Broker is a heartfelt drama about a pair of men who run an illegal business as baby brokers. They try to sell off an abandoned baby, are later joined by the baby's mother, and throughout the movie end up becoming their own found family. This is a South Korean film directed by Hirokazu Koreeda, and this is the same guy who directed Shoplifters, by the way, a movie that I very much enjoy, and I thought Broker was really, really beautiful. There's not much I can say about the film because the story is quite simple, but I really freaking loved it. The characters are charming and complex, the movie's full of some very emotional moments, and I really love the questions that this film asks in regards to morality and ethics. In real life, there is no such thing as an absolutely good or an absolutely evil person. We are all just people who sometimes make mistakes and sometimes make things that we can be proud of. And that is something that is beautifully reflected in this film. Even though this film's characters do some questionable stuff, we always understand where they're coming from, and we even question if what they're doing is truly that wrong. Now, on top of that, I also love the dilemma that this film poses in regards to prevention and instigation and how these things could be mutually related. In this movie, there are boxes all throughout the city that women can use anonymously to get rid of their babies if they don't want them anymore. Looking after these boxes, of course, there's a group of people who's in charge of taking care of the babies and taking them to orphanages, but this film poses a very interesting question in regards to these boxes. You know, these boxes were created as a way to prevent women from getting rid of babies in unsafe ways. But just because they exist, are these boxes actually incentivizing women to act rashly and get rid of their babies with little to no consideration? This is what I mean by the fact that this movie operates in a weird gray area that is difficult to define. These baby boxes are meant to be a good thing, but they could also be causing a bad thing simultaneously. So in conclusion, Broker was charming, heart-wrenching, incredibly moving, and yet another movie about found families from director Hirokazu Koreeda, but that's fine by me because I absolutely love them. If I were to give this film a score in between 1 to 10, I would give it a 9 out of 10 because I thought this film was amazing. Now, the second movie that I watched on October 8th and the very last movie that I saw in the 41st edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival was EO. EO is a movie about a donkey. Yes, EO follows a donkey as he encounters good and bad people and experiences joy and pain in many different scenarios. This is a Polish movie directed by Jerzy Skolimowski, and I thought this movie was good. And the first thing I'll say is that coming into this movie, I was very, very intrigued. I was intrigued, first of all, because it is not very often that you see a live-action movie with an animal for its protagonist, much less a donkey, but also because I sort of wanted to know what EO meant. Turns out, EO is the name of the donkey, and it is also onomatopoeia for the sound that donkeys make. So yeah, as I said, EO is good. It is very artsy, it is a bit inaccessible, but I thought it was fine. My main critique of the film is that I thought the movie was a bit too repetitive. You know, I know that the entire film is just meant to be a donkey meeting different people in different places, but after this happens 3 or 4 times, it just starts becoming stale, predictable, and very, very repetitive. Also, not a critique, but I was also very surprised to find out what this movie was really about. I thought this movie was just going to be about a donkey meeting different human beings and how humans are good or bad depending on, you know, who they are and where they come from. But no, in the second half of this movie, it became very clear that this is actually a movie about animal cruelty. As a result, some scenes in this film are very hard to watch, especially because the donkey is so freaking cute. But yeah, all in all, EO was a good movie with some important commentary, a very cute donkey, and a story that ended up becoming a bit too repetitive. My score for EO is a 6 out of 10, which means I thought it was good. And that is everything I watched at the 41st edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival. But now, before I wrap this up, I will go on to tell you my ranking of all 15 movies I saw at this year's VIF. Starting with number 15, Rabia Kurnaz vs. George W. Bush, a film that in my opinion was an absolute tonal mess. Then in number 14, we have EO, the movie about the donkey, which was good but repetitive. Then at number 13, I have Empire of Light, which is honestly one of the most disappointing films I've seen all year, but was still sort of good because of Olivia Colman's great performance. Then at number 12, I have Bones of Crows, a very important film with some very important commentary, but all in all, the narrative was a huge, huge mess. Then at number 11, I have Corsage, which is a very good film, but it's a bit forgettable. At number 10, I have Women Talking. A very good movie from Sarah Pauli with some great performances, but that at the end of the day felt a bit anticlimactic. Then at number 9, I have Close, a truly beautiful film that, you know, I just really freaking loved. Then at number 8, I have The Sun, a movie that apparently everyone hates except for me, but what can I say, I thought it was great. Then at number 7, I have RMN, the movie with the 15-minute long shot that really, really impressed me. Then at number 6, I have Triangle of Sadness, a movie that I think its first two acts are absolutely incredible, but it sadly loses its steam in the third act. Then at number 5, I have Broker, a beautiful, beautiful film that was able to pull in my heartstrings in unprecedented ways. Then at number 4, I have Decision to Leave, a neo-noir that, you know, completely captured my attention and I'm still thinking about to this day. Then at number 3, I have The Whale, the film with the single greatest performance I've seen this year and one of the best performances of all time with Brendan Fraser. Then, at number 2, I have Aftersun, a movie that I haven't been able to stop thinking since I saw it, and it just keeps getting better and better every time that I think about it. And then, at number 1, my favorite film of the entire film festival has to be The Banshees of Inisherin, an absolute masterpiece. And now, before we end this, I just want to thank once again everyone at VIFF for inviting us to cover the 41st edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival as members of the press. It was a great experience, we had a lot of fun, and from the bottom of my heart, it truly means a lot. We would also like to thank everyone at MPMG Arts Marketing for getting us so many cool interviews and opportunities, but specifically, we would like to thank Jacob Woik, Caterina Capisano, Laura Murray, Ines Mean, Angela Venader, and Angela Poon for all your help and support. Thank you so, so much. This was the first time we covered the Vancouver International Film Festival, and you all made sure our experience was truly, truly special. And that is it for everything I watched at VIFF and for our coverage of the 41st edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival. But now, before we wrap this up, it is time we go into our second and last musical break, and it is time we go listen to Under Pressure by Queen and David Bowie. This was a song that was featured at the very end of Aftersun. And here it is.
So slashed and torn.
Can we give love now?
pressure. Under pressure. Pressure.
Nothing goes together better than live music and a beer. Or two. Or five. Wait a minute. An estimated 886,000 Canadians age 15 and older abused or were dependent on alcohol in 2012. 1 in 7 Canadians age 15 years and older experience verbal, emotional, and physical abuse as a result of another person's drinking. Make sure a fun night out doesn't ruin everyone else's, or your own. If you see yourself or someone you know slightly off-key, help everyone out and step in. After all, you want to be able to remember the show tomorrow morning.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. I hope you'll enjoy that musical break. But now, it is time to say goodbye. Thank you all so much for tuning in for this episode of Take One, and I'll see you next week. Goodbye.